Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Middle East politics is stone cold serious. Israel's soldiers and spies and the Palestinians' militants compete so ruthlessly, the rest of the world just shakes its head. So it's more than a little incongruous that Mideast history took a hairpin turn in 1997 with a crazy tale of Israeli assassins saving the life of the man they tried to kill. You couldn't make this stuff up. This hour on Point, the story of the mission to kill Hamas leader Khaled Mashal. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the headlines back in 1997 about the mission to kill Khaled Mashal? Do you wonder what the story behind the story was? Can you imagine that these kinds of cloak and dagger, James Bond operations actually go on? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now, where it's the middle of the night, his time in Sydney, Australia, is Paul McGough. He's chief correspondent and former editor of Australia's Sydney Morning Herald and the author of the new book, Kill Khaled, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khaled Mashal and the Rise of Hamas. Welcome, Paul McGough.
Hello, Jackie.
Haven't seen you since Jordan. So I wanted...
Indeed.
This is an exhaustively reported account. I wondered when I heard you were doing it why you wanted to go back to this particular case. We'll just say Khaled Mashal today lives in Damascus as a mastermind of Hamas. Why'd you start with him in this case?
I started with him because I came to the story accidentally. It was late night after dinner talk in Amman, Jordan, with people, locals, former senior officials of the regime. And as they often do, they fall into sort of laments, if you like, for the late King Hussein and what a wonderful king he was. And in my attempt to elicit stories that would firm up the greatness of King Hussein, the story that they always came back to was his handling of the assassination attempt on Khaled Mashal. So, and the more I researched it, the more it occurred to me that this whole bungle was the transformative moment in the history of Hamas. Hamas was on its knees at the time. The Israeli security forces were cracking down on it. Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority forces were cracking down on it. They were on the run. They were under huge pressure. U.S. diplomats across the region at the time were reporting to Washington that, you know, Hamas was, you know, capable of being broken at this time. And enter Mossad to take out Khaled Mashal. And instead of taking him out, they provide Hamas with the circuit breaker it needed to draw breath, to anoint a new leader, to release another revered leader from prison, and to totally and utterly humiliate not just the fabled Mossad, but also the then Prime Minister and today's Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, Paul, your book, which has gotten praise from a lot of your fellow correspondents from all kinds of papers and outlets, really does read at its heart like it is a thriller. And why don't you tell us about the case? It starts with this crazy thing of Canadians, as they call themselves, checking into the venerable old Intercon there on the Third Circle in Amman, and they're people on a mission. Tell us what's going on. And we call it a thriller, so be thrilling.
Yes, the Mossad agents, about seven of them all up, entered the country disguised as Canadian tourists. They had a secret pouch delivered, which as best I could establish came into the country through the Israeli embassy's diplomatic pouch, which doesn't have to go through customs. In that bag was a bottle of poison. Now, Cold War aficionados will remember the 1978 London Tower Bridge attack on Georgi Markov, the Bulgarian dissident, who was poisoned with a ricin dart, which was fired from the tip of an umbrella.
I do remember that.
Yeah, and now this was Mossad's first break with what you might call conventional liquidation. Instead of shooting or bombing, they were going to go down the Georgi Markov route, and they were going to put a drop of poison into Khaled Mashal's ear without him knowing.
Mm-hmm. And they actually practice for this in Israel.
They They practiced this in the streets of Tel Aviv. They filmed the practice, and they were able to show the film to Benjamin Netanyahu to encourage him to accept the wisdom of this plan of attack. And what they did on the streets of Tel Aviv was they would have two agents walking towards each other on the pavement, and with their innocent victim on the pavement, one of the Mossad agents would open a pre-shaken can of soda, creating noise, fizz, moisture in the air. And as he walked past the target on one side, the poisoning agent would walk on the other side using only water. And while the target was distracted, the idea was that the second agent would use a nebulizer to spray the poison into the target's ear. They got this down to a fine act on the pavements of Tel Aviv.
This is the Marx Brothers element of this story. Yeah,
this is, and it's hard to understand how an organization such as the Mossad could allow this to happen to itself. I mean, an organization that exists on the strength of its fabled history. I mean, you go back to the raid on Entebbe, where Netanyahu's brother was the only Israeli loss. I mean, it was by comparison, this mission was literally the equivalent of going down to the corner shop to buy a loaf of bread.
Right. So this happened in late September of 1997, and the men, accompanied by one woman, a doctor, have arrived in Amman, and pretty quickly they go after their target.
They do indeed. They stake out his office, but even before they did the stake out of the office, they had his home staked out early on that morning, and Mishal's wife observed them. They gave themselves away almost at the first moment. As Mishal drove to the office, Mishal's driver became concerned that a green Hyundai car that was sitting on his tail was up to no good. As they pulled in, and that car then overtook them and disappeared. But as Mishal pulled in at the office, his office on Garden Street, he and his driver each sensed that something was wrong. The driver immediately wondered about a thick-set blonde man wearing sunglasses standing on the pavement. What was he up to? Mishal ordinarily would go around the front of the car. This time he took the longer route around the back of the car, and as his foot touched the pavement, the blonde with the glasses lunged at him. Now, none of this made sense from this moment on, and the rules of engagement that were given to the agents were explicit. If Michal's bodyguards were with him, do not engage. Now, it's never been publicly explained why they persisted with going on. Another problem was that there were three agents in situ on the pavement. They had an agreed form of and a well-practiced, long-practiced system of communication with each other by facial expression, smile, frown, and the rest of it. They would each know what the other was meaning. But the mere fact that Michal's bodyguard was on the pavement broke their line of sight, so they couldn't communicate with each other. Again, it was another reason to abort, but they chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
Michal's driver and his bodyguard, who was in a tail car, who arrived seconds later, attacked the Mossad guys. They didn't think that they saw the, and witnesses backed them up, they saw the agent's hand go up towards Michal's head, but they didn't understand what was happening. They didn't sense that this was a threat to his life, because
they didn't see a weapon.
They didn't see a weapon. A small grey instrument was seen in the hand of the blonde, but it was looked more like a tourist camera, which in fact it was disguised as. The nebulizer was disguised as a camera, so they didn't have the sense that this was a life-threatening attack on Michal. Notwithstanding that, Michal's bodyguard, Muhammad Abu Sayyaf, gave chase as the Israelis fled, they jumped into their getaway car, which was the green Hyundai, Abu Sayyaf waved down another car and just jumped in and told the a very surprised local driver to follow the Green Hyundai, which he did, and they went on, you know, the classic Hollywood-style fast car chase through the back streets of Amman before they then abandoned their car, the Israelis, and took off down the road on foot with Abu Sayyaf giving chase. They came towards near a market garden, where mm-hmm. one of the locals was growing vegetables, and fell upon each other amongst the vegetables and in the irrigation channels into the garden, where they took to each other with rocks. I mean, it was really Marx Brothers stuff.
Yeah.
They're beating each other on the head with rocks as they scrabbled in the dirt. A crowd gathered, and finally somebody, a Palestinian passing by, intervened and helped Abu Sayyaf to capture the two Mossad men. And they were delivered to the Jordanian authorities, and thereby King Hussein of Jordan had what Arab rulers rarely have in their dealings with Israel, and that was the upper hand, because he had two trophy prisoners to negotiate and bargain with.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the Israeli Mossad's mission to kill Hamas leader Khaled Mashal, how the assassins ended up fighting to save his life, and how that story changed the history of the Middle East. My guest this hour is Paul McGeough, chief correspondent of Australia's Sydney Morning Herald and the author of Kill Khaled, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khaled Mashal and the Rise of Hamas. Well, we left our story with King Hussein realizing he's got two Mossad agents on his hands, not something, as you point out, that every Arab ruler has every day of the week. But there's also some amazing declarations made to the Agence France-Presse reporter that you have in your book. And I don't want to paraphrase what you said. She is told that they have, the words are, a bizarre instrument has been used in this attack. Would you bring her into the story? Rania Habib.
This is Randa Habib, mm-hmm. the fabled Agence France-Presse bureau chief in Amman, a remarkable woman who seems to know everything that is happening in Amman and the region sometimes before it happens almost.
And she works this story around the clock for days. Yeah.
She works this story like a coal miner digging at a coal face. She's unrelenting, and she's a wonderful character in the story, because in the Middle East, first and foremost, as a woman, to get mm-hmm. a woman into the story gives you relief from the relentless procession of males in suits or robes. Yes, Randa was literally walking out of her office to go to the funeral for a friend's father when she got the phone call from one of the Hamas operatives to tell her that there had been an assassination attempt on Khaled Mashal. And, of course, her immediate response was, yeah, who did it? And they said, oh, well, actually, it was the Mossad. Yeah, well, you always say it's the Mossad that does everything. And the more they told her, and the more of the fantastic story she told them, the more she came to believe it because it was fantastic. Her view was that if they'd wanted to make something up, they wouldn't have gone so far. They didn't have the imaginative capacity to dream up this bizarre story, and that's what made her run with it.
What was the phrase? They said someone has used a bizarre instrument. Is that what they said?
Yes. She was, asking the basic journalist question, what happened? Was he shot? No. Was there an explosion? No. Well, if you're saying there was an assassination attempt, what was it? And the response was, they used a bizarre instrument. And, for a reporter reporting in English and French, the think of the French accenting of bizarre instrument. It was a wonderful moment for her. Other thing that she did was, rather than wait, she immediately put out a 25-word news flash, mm-hmm. which was picked up around the region instantly. And in getting it out, this was when the masterstroke of Hamas was to call Randa Habib. I mean, they literally just scooped Mashal off the pavement. They're wondering what to do. And the first concrete decision they make, still not knowing that Mashal is about to start dying, or is in the throes of dying, only they don't know it. They think he's been saved, so they reckon they've got nothing to lose. He's alive, and they can go after Hamas.
Right.
Sorry, after the Mossad.
Right. And we should just establish here, Paul, that for a long time, for some hours anyway, because of the poison that the Mossad agents had used, it wasn't clear right away that Khaled Mashal was in trouble.
No, the poison was a very a chemically manipulated version of fentanyl, quite a common post-operative painkiller, which is widely used around the world. But in this modified form, it was about 1,000 times stronger than morphine. And ordinarily, if you want to use this drug to kill somebody on the spot, you'll get it into their bloodstream as fast as you can. You'll put it on their tongue, or you'll put it into soft tissue so that it gets absorbed by the blood, goes to the brain, mm-hmm. and what it does is it shuts down the respiratory system. But again, in purely pure planning terms, one of the points of brilliance in the Mossad plan was that they didn't want fast absorption. They wanted slow absorption into Mashal's brain for these reasons. Israel had recently signed a peace treaty with Jordan, so it wasn't a good look to actually come into Jordan and start killing people in the streets of the capital. So what they wanted was they wanted Mashal to die slowly. They wanted him to go home and lie and have his lunch, whatever. He'd feel sleepy. He'd say, I'm going to have a lie down. And at the point of putting his head on the pillow and going to sleep, he would not wake up again. Not only would he not wake up again, if anyone decided to have an autopsy, this was a drug that left no trace of its passage through the body for the pathologist to find. So there would be no way of knowing how or why Khaled Mashal had died. He would have died of natural causes, would have been the autopsy conclusion. Now, to get slow absorption, they had to put it into a part of his body like the ear, because the membrane in the ear is a bit leathery, a bit heavier than soft tissue, and that meant slower absorption. So that was the time that the Israelis thought they would be able to remove their fingerprints from this killing. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, it became the time in which Mashal's life might be saved.
One of those plans that, on paper, look a heck of a lot more effective than it proved to be on the street. But let's bring in one of the major players here. Khaled has been sprayed in his ear with the bizarre instrument. And King Hussein has been alerted that he's got two Mossad agents, and indeed, they're not Canadians, they are Mossad agents, a couple of Canadian passports, which appear to be real, the real thing. He's got two agents in prison and four more holed up at the Israeli embassy in Amman, and a diplomatic crisis is international crisis is almost instantly on the boil.
It is, because Hussein was absolutely furious. He had been, his relationship with Netanyahu had been based on a remarkable decision by Hussein to actually back Netanyahu when he ran for election as prime minister, and to intervene in the Israeli election process by inviting Netanyahu to Amman so that Israeli voters would see that Netanyahu could get on with the local regional leaders. And he gave him a leg up to help him win the election. But Netanyahu's behavior in his handling of the Palestinian issue so offended offended King Hussein that he could not believe that he had been given this chance to humiliate, and he set out to humiliate Netanyahu, so much so that one of the CIA guys who was in Amman at the time and who sat in on the meetings observed that King Hussein wore his cat has had the canary expression on his face for much of the meetings where they thrashed around on how to handle this. But the first thing that Hussein did was to pick up the phone and call the White House. Now, kings, queens, generals, and dukes call the White House from time to time, but invariably they do so after weeks of negotiations by diplomats to set up a time to make sure the president is there. But in this case, Hussein actually picked up the phone without any pre-planning and called the White House and said, I need to speak to President Bill Clinton now.
Yeah. Now, you've got amazing descriptions in here of phones jangling around the world, people being gotten out of bed, away from kids' tennis matches. The American ambassador to Jordan is summoned from an archaeological dig in Petra by helicopter with his wife, and the king is arranging his cards. Let's bring in a caller calling from here in Boston. I want you to respond to him. Hello, Hadi. Hadi, how are you?
Yes, good, thanks. I read the book. One of the best books I read about the Middle East, Intimate Details. What I wanted to say was that it's ironic that nowadays the Israelis are dealing with the Palestinians, and around that time the Israelis are dealing with the PLO now, and at that time the PLO was the terrorist organization, and now Hamas, they were bringing Hamas up at that time. Israel was instrumental in the creation of Hamas, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And now the tables are turned. Now the PLO is the golden boy of Israel, and Hamas is the terrorist organization.
Okay, I'm not. Thank you for that interesting point. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it, Hadi, but thank you. But it is a point that I want to make, Paul, in that you have a moment where the American ambassador is brought in with the head of the CIA in Amman in the middle of the day to King Hussein's people and has to listen through this whole lecture. And what's the first thing he says to the CIA agent?
Well, the whole way through a meeting that lasted several hours, the name Khaled Mishaal was in just about every sentence. As King Hussein laid out his plans or his demands for what had to happen, for what Washington in particular had to do, it was Khaled Mishaal this, Khaled Mishaal that, Khaled Mishaal the other. And this went on and on. And as you said, the ambassador had been, a helicopter had been sent to fetch the ambassador, which meant he didn't have a car to leave the palace at the end of this meeting. So he jumped into Dave Manners, the CIA man's car, and literally as Manners put the key in the ignition, the ambassador who was sitting in the passenger seat turned to him and said, "Who the hell is Khaled Mishaal?"
It's not funny, but it's funny. I mean,
it's not funny, but it's very funny, because what it tells you is that nobody was really watching Khaled Mishaal as a serious player at the time, yet the Israelis had decided to make him a serious player and thereby anointed him as the leader of Hamas for the future. And today he is the leader of the Hamas.
Well, this is the hairpin turn, or the reverse, if this were the reveal, rather, if this were a Hollywood script. You can tell I haven't written one, in which they quickly realize, because of King Hussein's demand, that Khaled Mishaal, hitherto obscure Hamas operative, must not die. And why is that?
He must not die because if he dies, at this stage King Hussein has the Israeli embassy in Amman surrounded by his own military. He's warning that if Khaled Mishaal dies, the Mossad agents will hang in Amman. He's also warning that the Middle East peace process, in which he was a pivotal player, would be shut down. He had the power to do that. All in all, and we're at that stage in the Clinton presidency where Clinton, at the moment there's much congratulations and admiration for President Obama in daring to tackle the Middle East crisis early in his first term as president. The history has been that American presidents tackle it late in their second term. This is more or less what Clinton was doing at the time, and he couldn't afford to have any impediment to the process. So King Hussein had everybody on toast in terms of what he was demanding, and what he demanded was that the White House order the Israelis to hand over not only the poison, but also, sorry, not only an antidote, they also wanted a sample of the poison, and they wanted the chemical explanation for the poison and the antidote so that they would understand the relationship between the two of them, because one of their greatest fears was that, not having done the job properly the first time, anything the Israelis gave them by way of an antidote could well turn out to be a second poison to finish Mishal off.
Right. And of course, let's also remind listeners that King Hussein had his own credibility to worry about, too. I mean, it may seem at variance that King Hussein would be threatening to hang the Mossad agents in Amman, but he had his own kingdom to defend.
He did. His throne was from time to time quite precarious, and one of the sort of the sleepers, if you like, in Jordanian demographics is that because of the whole Middle East crisis, half his population were Palestinian refugees. Now, not only were they refugees, but they were also... That was one part of the problem. The other part of the problem was, with the word having got out through Randa Habib and her AFP reporting that Mishal had been attacked by the Mossad, if he died, there was going to be the immediate assumption that the Mossad could not have operated in Jordan without the complicity of King Hussein. King Hussein would have been reviled not just by the Palestinian half of his population, but also by the most of the Arab and Muslim world.
And so King Hussein is demanding that President Clinton tell Netanyahu, get me the antidote. He couldn't make this
get
up.
Me
get
the
me
antidote.
The antidote and get it now.
Get me the antidote and get it to me before midnight Saturday.
Right.
That's what he said.
And this is as President Clinton is attending a rally, I think, in Little Rock, and he's got, you know, 10-minute snatches throughout the day to try and basically come up with this as if he was part of the mastermind, and I suppose as a Middle East player he was, you know, in terms of finding a solution.
He was. He had a good team at work around him. Dennis Ross, Sandy Berger, who was the National Security Advisor, Bruce Rydell, who was one of his... advisors on Near Eastern Affairs, as his formal title at the time was. And they were working the phones, as you said earlier. The phones were going all around the world, from Jerusalem to the White House, from Amman to the White House, from the CIA to the State Department, to the embassy in Amman, to the embassy in Tel Aviv. I mean, it was just this incredible exercise where all the advice that Clinton was getting, and it was one of those rare moments, as I was told by a very reliable source in Washington, that it was one of those rare moments where nobody in the White House, nobody in the Clinton team would go into bat for Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
They all told him, you're on your own, you've got to comply. Mm-hmm. And he then called a late night meeting on the Saturday night, a meeting of his security cabinet. And as one of the persons who was present for that meeting told me, they were very upset with the constant phone calls from Washington telling them what to do. They were really, really peeved about this. As this guy said to me, he said, it wasn't as though we didn't know what we had to do. He said, and he paused. He said, we'd put the guy in the grave and now we had to pull him out.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leighton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the attempts by Israel to kill top Hamas leaders, how one such mission went spectacularly wrong, and how policy by assassination is still part of the game. My guest is Paul McGeough, chief correspondent of Australia's Sydney Morning Herald and the author of Kill Khaled, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khaled Mashal and the Rise of Hamas. So where we left it was that the White House is constantly bothering Benjamin Netanyahu and his men, who have been told that get us the antidote by midnight or your agents hang. Pretty dramatic moment. Then what happens? There is a new character in the game.
Sorry, there's
a new character in the game who comes in to tell the Israelis the problem is that you're thinking about your own solutions. You're not thinking about King Hussein's.
Yes. This was the in his desperation to find a crisis manager, Netanyahu looked around the entire Israeli government establishment, and the only man he could light upon who might be able to help was Ephraim Halevi, a former senior figure in the Mossad, who at that stage was working as Israel's ambassador to the European community in Brussels. He was on a train driving, going to Dusseldorf with his wife to buy some furniture because they were about to return to Israel when he got the phone call ordering him to return immediately.
This is where you have all the details, Paul. This is what I love. What they were doing at that moment, they got the calls. So he is basically an amazing. He's sort of the Lawrence of Arabia figure, if you will, coming in here.
He is, because he was described as the father of the treaty with Jordan. People outside the region sometimes lose track of how the business of diplomacy and intergovernment relations in that part of the world are conducted. Usually it is through intelligence agencies, not through State Department equivalents. So you have intelligence agents, spooks and spies setting up the terms of treaties and doing the door opening and the hand shaking and the rest of it to in the hope of making things happen. And there's a long sort of covert history pre the treaty, a long covert history of negotiations and dealings between Jordan and Israel. So Halevi was a very close friend of King Hussein's, had been overnight guest many a time at the royal palace in Amman, and was considered genuinely a friend of the family. So he was believed to be the only one who could resolve this crisis. And when he arrived back in Jerusalem, he was quite shocked to find that the people who were in charge of trying to solve the crisis didn't really understand what they were doing. They didn't have the finesse, if you like, for understanding the problem they had created, and could only look at it in terms of trying to solve their own problem, instead of understanding that to make this thing go away, they first had to solve King Hussein's problem.
Right.
So they had to come up with a solution that was good enough for King Hussein, something that would allow King Hussein to stand before his own population, before the Arab world, before the Muslim world, and say, look what I got out of this.
And it had to be good.
It had to be good. Now, there's debate between former intelligence agents in both countries as to who first came up with the idea. But on the Israeli side, the idea was first put on the table by Ephraim Halevi, and that was that that Benjamin Netanyahu was going to have to offer to King Hussein the release from Israeli prison of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin,
the founder of Hamas.
Mm-hmm. At this point, when that name was uttered, the Mossad negotiators who were with Ephraim Halevi when he uttered that name, they fell out of their chairs in disbelief. Nobody, they argued, could release Yassin for any reason. He was a huge, towering figure in the Hamas movement, notwithstanding the fact that he was confined to a wheelchair, notwithstanding the fact that he was a crippled paraplegic. He was the brains trust behind so much of what Hamas had been doing through its formative years, and the idea of releasing him was anathema.
Well, it would be like a little bit like releasing Joe Stalin if you had him behind bars.
Yes, or inviting Saddam, inviting Saddam from his holding cell in Baghdad to come to the White House for afternoon tea.
Mm-hmm. But they had to do it. Let's take a call right here because it's germane to our storyline. Daniel is calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hey, Daniel, hello.
Yes, hi, how you doing? I want to thank you very much for sharing this story, and I want to thank your guest. Actually, the way he described the whole situation was very realistic. I wasn't a man at that time. I have one quick question. When and how did the Israeli's prime minister know about that, and what was his first reaction, his first response when he received the news? Thank you very much again.
Okay. Well, when he received the news, How much responsibility did Benjamin Netanyahu admit? And let's also say there was a big press blackout in Israel, so Israeli citizens didn't know much about this for a long time.
They didn't, because there was the general state censorship was at work, but also the country had shut down for the Jewish New Year, which and most of the newspapers didn't publish at that time. So getting the story out was, or keeping the story in, if you like, was relatively easy for the government. But how did he find out about it? Again, it was one of those exquisite moments, because in the days before Jewish New Year, the Prime Minister visits various government instrumentalities to thank the staff for their work during the year. And his visit to the Mossad headquarters near Tel Aviv was timed to take place about an hour after the hit in the streets of Amman. And he fully expected to arrive to be given great news by Danny Yatom, the head of the Mossad at the time, when he went in to thank all the Mossad agents for their work during the year, and this was going to be a great celebration of another victory. But as he arrived, Yatom went out to meet him and took him aside and told him that it was absolute disaster in the streets of Amman. So a very bad moment, which notwithstanding the fact that Netanyahu had micromanaged the whole planning and execution of the mission. At the end of the day, he was absolved of wrongdoing by at least two inquiries, sanitized reports which were published by each.
But how did the Israelis come round to the demand? Whoever originated it, whether it is originated on the at the suggestion of the Israeli former Mossad director, the Jordanian side. How do they come around to giving up Sheikh Yassin?
Again, one of those spectacular moments. Khaled Mishaal had been the Jordanian medical authorities had hit on the right antidote for Mishaal ahead of the delivery of the sample that the Israelis sent. He was coming to in hospital, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, he came to in his hospital bed to find the towering figure of King Hussein standing by his bed. Now, kings don't wander the corridors of hospitals at 2 o'clock in the morning unless something's about to happen.
And King Hussein never really towered except in his reputation. But anyway, go on.
Yes, yes. I thought I'd try and explain that, and then I decided, no, I'll just glide past that.
I just thought I'd help you out here.
Yes, yes. Right. He was a very little man.
Yes. But a great one. So yeah. Anyway.
So Mishaal, they exchanged words, and then King Hussein left the room where Mishaal was bedded. But shortly afterwards, Mishaal heard the noise of a helicopter and dragged himself out of the bed and to the window to look down as a Jordanian military helicopter put down in the garden of the hospital, with King Hussein standing erect at the edge of the makeshift helipad where the helicopter landed. The doors of the helicopter were thrown open, and the first item to be offloaded was a battered old wheelchair. And at that point, anyone looking, their breath just stopped, because the only person they could think of who was coming out of a helicopter at that time of night to be greeted by the King of Jordan was Sheikh Yassin. He was taken into the hospital and examined and found to be, he had very ongoing health problems, but basically he was fine and he would be released a couple of days later. And you had this dramatic operation, because not only did Hussein demand the release of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, he also looked around the sort of the chessboard of the region and worked out who he needed to satisfy. He needed to satisfy Hamas. He had to get something enough out of the Israelis to keep Hamas happy. But Hamas was a rival of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement, so he had to get something for Arafat and for Fatah. He had to get something for Jordanians. So what he demanded, apart from the release of Yassin, was the release of a whole bunch of Fatah prisoners, the release of any Jordanians held in Israeli prisons, and the release of a bunch of other Hamas prisoners. So what you then had was helicopters going both ways across the Jordan River, taking the released prisoners into Jordan, taking the released Mossad agents back to Jerusalem, and then once that had all happened, another helicopter taking Sheikh Ahmed Yassin back to Gaza. And that really grated with the Israelis, because they thought that they could pull a stunt where they would release Yassin from prison but insist that he be given refuge in Amman in Jordan. And King Hussein said, he's going home.
To Gaza. Yeah.
He's going home to Gaza City.
Where, as we know today, Hamas has been democratically elected. But let's take a call from Doug in Nashville. Because, Doug, I'd like to get you into the store here. Hi. Can you quickly tell us your question?
Sure. A couple of questions. One, I wanted to respond to your comment of this assassination every now and then, what it takes for a free country. But surely the goodness our country has learned through the Church Committee revelation, in the CIA bungling in Guatemala, Chile, the Congo, Vietnam, why do countries not have to relearn the lesson that a targeted assassination is nothing more than state-sponsored murder? And when the Israelis do it, I don't see how they have the right to turn around and complain about terrorism from the Palestinian side when they assassinate their leaders. Right. I'll let you respond.
Well, Paul, I'm going to conveniently punt that one to you. This is there are a long list of countries who do things like this, and the U.S. is culpable.
There's a long list of countries. Espionage agencies have resorted to assassination right down through history. If we confine ourselves to the Middle East crisis, Israel has run a systematic campaign of targeted assassinations, which they've conducted not only within Israel and the occupied territories. They've taken it international. Everyone will remember after the Munich Olympics, the massacre of the Israeli athletes at the games. The Mossad embarked on a systematic killing mission right around Europe, taking out anyone they believed had been involved in the Munich massacre. On the ground in the occupied territories, Israel has run a frightening campaign of targeted assassination of anyone who is involved with Hamas and also with Fatah, who they think is a kingpin. And what they haven't learned is that taking these guys out has not produced the effect. Hamas has got prides itself on naming a replacement for any leader who is assassinated by the Israelis within 24 hours. And traditionally, one of the strong points of Hamas has been its ability to produce new leadership. From time to time, Israel hasn't just taken out individuals, it's taken out whole layers of leadership. And when that has happened, Hamas has had a whole new layer of leadership in waiting to stand up immediately.
So one of the points you're making here, in the little time we've got left, is that a state can't, if you will, kill or assassinate its way out of this kind of dilemma. I'm thinking a little bit of the historic tensions between England and Ireland in years past and the decades and centuries of resistance in Ireland. That in the case of Hamas, which now holds sway, that kind of policy of assassination just has not had its desired effect.
It doesn't work, and the idea that you can sort of keep shooting until you get the negotiating partner you want is patently absurd.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work that way. You can't make people... You can't choose your enemies. You can't choose your partner in peace, and you can't try to filter out the ones you don't like among your enemies by shooting them.
Mm-hmm.
You just make more enemies.
Was anyone reluctant to talk to you for this book? You've interviewed dozens of people.
Very few were reluctant. Some were careful about the terms on which they spoke. A lot of them spoke without being named. Some very key individuals chose to not allow me to reveal that they had spoken. But for the most part, they were all willing. One who didn't speak to me, who refused to speak to me, was Netanyahu.
Who?
Benjamin Netanyahu.
I know who he is. I was going to say, who is, of course, Prime Minister again today, and who will face an old opponent, Khaled Mishaal.
That's right.
Well, Paul, it's an absolutely fascinating book, and we really thank you for being with us and for all the work you did in reporting it. Paul McGough, and his book is called Kill Khaled, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khaled Mishaal and the Rise of Hamas. And thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Jackie.
Yes. And good night to you now. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.